Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and as always, I'm joined by co-host Frank Cogliano. How are you feeling, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. How are you today?
I'm actually getting over a pretty bad fever I've had all weekend, so I've been a bit under the weather, but I'm like 97% well right now, so my apologies if I cough or some other kind of thing during the podcast.
Well, I'm sorry you were unwell, but glad you're on the mend.
Yeah, but it's in some ways it's appropriate that I'm doing this in a kind of medical recovery mode, because the theme for this week is about healthcare. And we're doing this, I guess, because the Republicans released the Senate version of their healthcare bill last week and might vote on it this week. Is that sort of the rumors right now?
Well, the intention, I think, Mitch McConnell, the majority leader in the Senate, is hoping, I think, that the bill can be voted on before the 4th of July break, which starts this weekend.
All right. Well, we're not going to talk...
And we might discuss the urgency of it,
this,
but anyway.
But what we thought we'd do today is sort of give a sort of a long view and try to explain, to the best that we understand it, the American healthcare system.
Yes, I think we need to make clear, David, that nobody actually understands the American healthcare system.
Because we teach this class together about the history, survey of the United States, and one of the things the students always ask me at the end of the year, I sometimes have a end of year session, tutorial session, where I let them ask me anything they don't understand, and they're like, explain to us again. And the two questions I've gotten every year I've done this are, what is it with guns? And explain this healthcare system you guys have, because it doesn't make any sense to them. And I think, that's the hard part, I think, for us as Americans trying to explain the American healthcare systems to people here in the UK, because it doesn't really make any logical, coherent sense. Nobody designed it this way.
Well, I think one thing to bear in mind is it's not actually a system.
And
I'm not being cute. System implies a coherence that simply doesn't exist. And I think what we want to talk about today is how that came to pass.
Do you want to do a disclosure about your relationship with the healthcare system here locally?
Well, I'll just...
we had a conflict of interest here.
Yes, I have a conflict of interest. I would say that my wife, who was introduced to you last week as a Wonder Woman fan, is a general practitioner. She's a GP in the National Health Service here in Scotland. So I can draw a contrast between my knowledge of the NHS, both as a consumer, as a user, as a patient in the NHS over 25 years, but also as being somebody married to somebody who works within the system.
And full disclosure for me, I obviously don't have the same kind of length of experience Frank has, but I've had some pretty substantial interactions with the NHS over the past 4 years. And it's been one of those sort of great experiences of my life. So we're both slightly biased, or at least have different experiences in that regard. All right, so if we're talking about the history of government and healthcare and government involvement in healthcare, is there any government involvement in healthcare, Frank, in the colonial era or early revolution, much of anything?
Not all that much. There's a little bit of occasionally the local governments will urge their populations to become inoculate, usually against smallpox. Although it's important to bear in mind that the process of inoculation in the 18th century was different from modern inoculation.
Modern vaccination.
Vaccination, yes, that's right. So people would be exposed to the disease and sometimes die from it. But what we tend to see is in the 18th century is these efforts are relatively haphazard. I suppose what we're thinking about, David, is... In terms of our theme for this episode, is really public health. Public health efforts, in part because the understanding of medicine was so rudimentary in the 18th century, at least by modern standards, because public health efforts were pretty haphazard and patchy, I think, at best. It's really, as you well know, in the 19th century where... there's at least the beginnings of a debate about what the role of the government should be in healthcare. I don't know. So I'm afraid I've got relatively little to bring.
There is probably the book to look to, I guess, in the Revolution era that I think of is Lil Fenn's Pax Americana, which talks in part about, you know, the history of inoculation and the sort of perils of it, and this role of the state a little bit. But
there isn't much. And the degree to which, you know, the great smallpox epidemic of the latter 18th century actually shaped the creation of the United States. But that wasn't, in terms of us thinking about healthcare systems, yeah, it's not really in place. Yeah. So there are the beginnings of private hospitals and things like that in the 18th century, which are quite important. And indeed, an alumnus of this particular august institution, Benjamin Rush, is a leading figure in the history of American medicine.
And signer of the Declaration of Independence.
Yes. And so the beginnings of medicine in the United States are laid down in the 18th century, and medical education. And there's a direct correlation between, again, the University of Edinburgh in particular, and that history. But we don't quite see... I don't think we can trace the lineage of the mess that is modern American healthcare.
Okay.
There are a lot of things we can blame the 18th century for, not this.
Not this. Now, granted, like 18th century healthcare, it was pretty lousy. Yeah. These leeches and stuff. So,
yeah,
you know, in the 19th century, there are a few, I think, important antecedents that helped to sort of contextualize, or at least bring up some of the same themes. There are actually really substantial state-funded institutions for healthcare that people often don't think about, and those would be state, and to use the terminology of the time, either lunatic asylums or insane asylums, and homes for the blind and deaf, and these are, a lot of these were instituted in the 1830s and 1840s. These are part of the big reform movements that are taking place during the Second Great Awakening. A lot of these, especially the insane asylums, are sponsored by, or sort of pushed by, religious reformers, people like Dorothea Dix, who go from state to state, urging state legislatures to form these institutions. And, you know, thinking about state expenditure in the 19th century, in the early 19th century, these are major sources of state expenditure. If you're thinking about the institution the state is spending money on, and that they spend time focusing on in the legislature and the governor's mansion, the insane asylum and the home for the deaf and blind are right up there with the state university and the state prison, really, as being big institutions that they're focusing on.
That's right. I mean, I think it bears thinking about a little, David, or at least reminding ourselves that, you know, when Alexis de Tocqueville came to the United States and in the early 1830s and wrote, and subsequently wrote his great study of America, Democracy in America, he was coming to visit and study America's prisons.
Yeah.
Because, and the prison movement and the penitentiary movement is kind of runs in parallel to the asylum movement, when the United States was actually seen at the cutting edge of in terms of treatment and reform, in terms of both punishment and the treatment of people with mental illnesses. Now, in certain ways, we haven't moved beyond the 1830s, but it is interesting that that was a point where the United States was actually leading the world in these areas. And so the debate over the use of public funds to support such activity is interesting in that context, I guess.
The twist in it, though, if you think about this as being a success in the 19th century in terms of state funding for healthcare, there was a move in the 1850s to create a national fund to benefit the insane, to use the 19th century terminology, and the blind and the deaf. That went through Congress, and it went through both the House and the Senate to create sort of a slush fund to help sort of establish these institutions. And President Franklin Pierce vetoed it. Franklin Pierce is not very well remembered as a president, didn't do very much, but he did veto this bill. And his rationale, I think, is interesting. He said, healthcare should be the purview of the states, not the federal government, which I think is a theme that we'll see running throughout sort of the healthcare debates that come in the 20th century, that the federalism of it dictates that healthcare, like education, other kinds of similar things, should be left to local communities, not to the national government to decide.
That's very interesting, because as you say, it's a major theme in 20th and 21st century debates about healthcare.
It's also, you know, one of the few things that gets vetoed. I mean, there aren't that many vetoes in the 19th century.
Yeah, that's true. That's interesting. What happens, David, thinking about your own period of expertise, both during and after the Civil War? Because obviously, I mean, the Civil War at some level could be seen as a major public health crisis.
Oh, to be sure.
and medical care is being provided by the government.
Yes. And it's being provided by the government in a couple of ways. Obviously, there are thousands of doctors who are participating with the military, helping wounded soldiers. So there's an enormous medical corps attached to all the armies, amputating limbs, doing other deeply unpleasant things. There's also doctors who are working for the Freedmen's Bureau after the war. And so the question is, you know, about the federal government actually providing health care for African Americans who have been recently emancipated. It doesn't last very long because the Freedmen's Bureau doesn't last all that long, and there aren't that many doctors who do it, but it is an example of a federally run healthcare entitlement in the 19th century. You also have lots of states in the aftermath of the war, especially southern states, who spend an enormous amount of their state budget doing things like providing artificial limbs for Confederate veterans who have had limbs amputated. So for disabled soldiers. There's a great book by Brian Craig Miller that looks at the ways in which state and local governments are spending a lot of their time and resources trying to figure out, well, who gets artificial limbs and which artificial limbs to use and other kinds of things. It's got some really gruesome illustrations for those people who are into that kind of thing. But those programs obviously are linked to particular times and places, and they're not going to carry on after that generation of people have passed away.
So, yet again, as in so many ways, Reconstruction is a turning point, and there's a road not taken.
Taken, yes.
Wishes.
The episodes of healthcare there are very targeted in some ways. It's disabled veterans get certain particular, you know, access to healthcare. African Americans are in a very particular window in this transition from slavery to freedom, get certain kinds of healthcare. Although how good the healthcare is has been a matter of some debate. There's lots of African Americans who die during the Civil War and Reconstruction due to lack of access to healthcare. That's probably a bigger story than the healthcare they do get. Thinking about, though, going into the end of the 19th century and early part of the 20th century, one of the important developments you have is the professionalization of medicine as a discipline. What it meant to be a doctor in the sort of first half of the 19th century is you went around and said, I'm a doctor, let me perform surgery on you. And if you looked the part and had a medical bag and maybe had gone to medical school for a while, that was largely good enough. During the Progressive Era, there's increasing efforts to regulate medicine as a discipline, to regulate access to, you know, who can call themselves a legitimate doctor, who can prescribe medicines, control of pharmacology as a discipline. You have groups like the American Medical Association being formed during the late 19th and early 20th century, and various sort of ancillary organizations.
And to a large extent, that's a trade union that's kind of governed, or a guild. Operating as a guild, sort of. It's a gatekeeper for who can.
But you have the
professional standards.
And, you know, medicine is in line with other professions that are doing the other things at the same time. So the American Bar Association is founded at the same time.
American Historical Association.
That was good. Very important. We're right up there with doctors and lawyers in terms of our. I've been to the American Bar Association meetings. They're much snazzier than AHA meetings.
Okay.
The food's better. AHA meetings are fun. Don't want to offend any AHA people listening. I think the real story starts in the 20th century, the important ways in which American healthcare diverges from the rest of the industrialized world. And I think one of the places you see it.
It should be said, sorry, before we
yes.
before we get to the divergence, in the first half of the 20th century,
yes.
essentially, with the professionalization of medicine and the creation of the American Medical Association, etc., we have a kind of system which will be idealized by many people to this very day, when you kind of had your local doctor, mm-hmm. your general practitioner who treated you, and you paid him, and it was almost always a him, for services.
Yeah.
And it was a transaction, but it wasn't unlike, it was a local and face-to-face transaction.
Yes.
And if you had something serious with you, wrong with you, you might go to the local hospital.
Mm.
But most of the treatment was done locally and carried out by somebody who you paid for the service.
And if you paid them cash, if you had cash, and you could pay them in eggs if you had eggs.
Right, that's right. And so the kind of image, an American archetype is sort of the country doctor.
Yeah.
The local doctor.
And just then, like the one-room schoolhouse. There's a idealized past that has some bearing in reality, but also is in some ways largely a creation. Because the country doctor wasn't great. Right, I mean, the quality of medical care was professionalized, but it wasn't. They could deal with your broken leg. They could deal with the various sort of minor maladies that you can fix with what you've got in your doctor's bag. But more sort of profound treatments, I think, are sort of that's in the future.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
One of the things you start seeing is that this professional body of doctors starting to exert their influence on the political process. You see movements during the progressive era of states trying to institute state-sponsored healthcare, and doctors' organizations, especially the AMA, coming out against it.
Why?
They didn't want government controlling, making the choices for them, and therefore regulating their wages, right? They thought, okay, our relationship with our, then the rhetoric they used, and I think it's the rhetoric you still see in some of these debates, our relationship with our patients is so important and so personal, we don't want the state interfering with our relationship with our patients. So the AMA came out against local efforts at the state level and the sort of city level to institute government-sponsored, orchestrated healthcare. You see the same thing during the New Deal with Social Security. The early drafts of Social Security included healthcare provisions in it, but those were all stripped out because the AMA opposed it, saying that this is government-sponsored socialist healthcare and we don't want it. And the government, in large part, deferred to the AMA as sort of the repository of wisdom on what's good for healthcare. And taking that out. But the real turning point, I think, happens during World War II. Do you want to explain that, Frank? Or do you want me to do that?
I think, actually, in our discussions, David, you seem to have a better grasp of this than I do.
Okay. So,
I've got views, but I think you've got a better grasp on the details.
The thing about American healthcare that has never made any sense to me, and has caused more problems, I think, for people than anything else, has to do with this linkage of employment and health insurance. And where that originates is in World War... There's some of it that happens before World War II, but the place where it really takes off is during World War II, in which there are wage controls on a number of professions that are imposed by the government during wartime. But there's basically zero unemployment, especially in certain skilled professions because of the war and all the various demands. And so one of the ways in which you have corporations trying to get employees is by adding benefits to their employment. And one of the benefits you could add is healthcare. You could say, look, we can only pay you this amount, but we can add in this healthcare coverage for you and maybe for your family. And you see large health corporations having their origin really in the World War II era. Things like Blue Cross start then. And this only gets ramped up when the war ends in the late 40s and early 50s. At one point, I think in the early 50s, and this is, I think, the sort of big turning point, the IRS concludes that when corporations pay premiums for employees, they can deduct that on their corporate taxes.
So health insurance premiums.
Health insurance premiums. So therefore, it benefits corporations on a tax basis to insure their employees. They can go to their employees and say, look, I'm giving you this kind of compensation that's not compensation for you and your family. And so it sort of works both ends in the corporation's best interest.
Right. I mean, that's really helpful background, Dave, because, of course, what we see in the 50s and subsequently is the emergence of this very strong link between employment and healthcare.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about divergence, this is the very period when the other industrialized democracies, to a large extent, create national health services or national health systems. So this is what
UK
happens
is in
1947.
Right.
So it's right after the war. And, of course, there's a massive renegotiation in the middle of the 20th century of the relationship between the individual and the state, not just in the United States, but around the world. And this is part of that, I think. But the U.S. is an outlier in, and of course, the significance, the divergence didn't seem that significant necessarily at the time, but it will become so because, of course, for at least white males, there's virtually full employment in the United States.
Yeah.
And wages are relatively high in the aftermath of the Second World War. And this health as a benefit or health insurance for one's family as a benefit of employment seemed a really good idea.
And labor unions are fairly strong. Labor unions, you know, demand health insurance as being part of the coverage.
That's right. Yeah. But it also ties people to their employer in ways that I think were unremarkable in the 1950s when it seemed reasonable. Like if you'd been demobilized, if you were a white working class man, say, in Michigan, you could work for Ford or General Motors or what have you and have a well-paid job for life that included health insurance. It doesn't suit This system doesn't necessarily suit the way of the world of work today, where people work, have casual contracts and so on, and move about more often. When I was recently in the United States, I spoke to a friend who mentioned that she's postponing retirement because she's got health insurance through her employer and can't afford to take early retirement and pay for health insurance before Medicare would kick in. And so people, the way the system's evolved, people have to make choices about their employment based on health care, whereas it was just meant to be an add-on and a little bit of a top-up to one's salary and benefits 70 years ago.
Sure. And, it's worth, I think, pointing out, there's lots of consequences of this weird relationship between employment and healthcare. One is this point that your employment decisions are going to be in part based on what kind of healthcare, they have and all kinds of things. It's also worth pointing out who gets left behind in a system like that. The kinds of occupations that gave healthcare were full-time jobs, white-collar jobs and skilled blue-collar jobs for white people.
Right.
So, if you are an African American, if you're a farmer, if you're self-employed, if you're a woman, if you're working as domestic, so there's a large percent of the population that doesn't have access to the healthcare in this system. So if you're working, at McDonald's, which is founded about this time, you don't have access to healthcare because, low wage employers don't offer healthcare to their employees. It tends to be, industrial workers and above on the wage scale that tend to have access to it. So there's lots of people who are left out of the system by this sort of linking of employment and healthcare. And people may end up making sort of weird choices as a consequence about when do I retire, can I afford to change jobs because healthcare would be different or not.
That's right, and it's frequently an issue. It becomes an issue when people are interviewing for jobs. And again, it can be something that attracts employees to certain corporations or to certain jobs or professions. But it, as you say, it's also excluding large numbers of people at the same time.
All right, so thinking about if that system is developing in the 40s and 50s, what's the government's response to how do you help the people who are left behind by that? And in, Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, I think he has two big programs that are meant to sort of remedy some of the gaps, or gaps is probably too long, but it's, you know, diminutive.
Well, to extend the reach of healthcare.
Yeah, to give healthcare to people who are left behind by the system. And the two programs they create, I think, are probably well known to the listeners, Medicare and Medicaid, which for the disadvantage of undergraduates sound too much alike, and they always confuse which one's for old people and which one's for poor people. So Medicare is, they're both created in 1965, so that makes it easy for them to get that right on the identification. So they're created sort of, thinking about when this happens.
The part of the Great Society.
So it fits in, it's the year after the Civil Rights Act, it's the same year as the Voting Rights Act. It's in that panoply of programs. So they sound very similar, and they are very similar in some ways, but they're actually also very different in the way they're implemented. I'm going to vastly oversimplify these, so if there's any health policy specialist listening to this, my apologies.
I think we've made clear
that our superficial knowledge on all things is abundant every week. And I'm sick, so that's my excuse.
You really need some health care.
Luckily, I have good health care because I'm in Scotland. So Medicare creates a system in which there is federally sponsored health insurance for people over the age of 65, that's run by the federal government, that Americans pay into through their payroll taxes. So if you look at your W-2 form, it tells you every year how much you've paid into to Medicare. Medicaid is a sort of parallel program that's designed to provide health care for those people who are very poor. It's run in a very different way, I think, in as much as it's funded by the federal government and by state governments, but it's administered by state governments. So that what Medicaid looks like in every state is going to be slightly different, and what the criteria are and what the thresholds are for getting Medicaid is going to be different in Maryland and Virginia. So it's a sort of national poor healthcare program, but it's poor healthcare plans, healthcare for the poor program, but it varies on a local level.
So we're back to Franklin Pierce.
Yes, yeah.
Although the funding comes from the federal government, it is administered locally by the states, who can top it up as well.
Yes. The mechanics of it and the funding of it sometimes baffles me. But I think that's how it works. Now, that still leaves a whole lot of people behind, right? If you're thinking about sort of how they're trying to fill these gaps, I think a large part of the debate in healthcare over the past 50 years is sort of how do you fill people who are left behind? How do you fix the sort of gaps? The people who don't have healthcare through their employer, people who don't have healthcare because they are poor enough they qualify for Medicaid, people who are under the age of 65 and all these kinds of things.
Right, I mean, one of the real public health problems that has confronted the United States for decades is the number of uninsured people.
Yeah.
And it is in the tens of millions. I think it was 40 million when Obamacare was adopted in 2009-10, if memory serves. So there's a substantial proportion of the population. Were 40 million, that's more than 10%, who are not covered by either private insurance that they're getting through an employer or simply paying for Medicare or Medicaid.
Yeah. And, some of these people are self-employed, some of these people are unemployed, but they don't qualify for Medicaid for whatever reason. There's lots of reasons why you could be very poor and not qualify for Medicaid. And so the solution
is young people,
and people who there's all kinds of reasons why you wouldn't fall into these could fall between the cracks, and buying insurance on the private market. Let's imagine these people who don't have insurance historically. If they wanted to buy insurance, what's the problem with that?
it's incredibly expensive. If you're an individual trying to buy insurance. If you're a major corporation and you want to buy an insurance policy for your employees, you can negotiate a deal with the insurance company. So the insurance company, the corporation is probably doing, is getting a decent rate.
Yeah.
But it's the individual trying to buy insurance, it's an incredibly expensive proposition.
Mm-hmm. And it's an especially expensive proposition if you are, let's say you're, if you're a young person who doesn't have insurance, buying insurance is probably not a young, very healthy person buying insurance. You can probably get an okay rate, especially if you. But if you are an older person but not old enough to qualify for Medicare, let's imagine you're 60 years old and you've been a lifelong smoker and you've got some other kind of health issues. You go and you try to buy private insurance, they say, great, it's going to be some huge astronomical number that you can't afford. So there's lots of people who are sort of priced out of the market based on this term, which doesn't exist in the UK, but is, I think, a term that all Americans have heard about, this idea about pre-existing conditions. Right?
Yes, so you've got some illness, or you've had an illness.
Therefore, we can't insure you, or we will insure you, but only at a price level that makes no sense.
Right, because the way, insurance companies are for-profit companies,
right.
And they're trying to manage risk. So what they want are people who buy insurance but don't use it, which are young people,
yes.
Ideally. Although a lot of young people just don't buy insurance at all.
Oh, yes.
Whereas people who need insurance are more costly to insurance companies.
Yeah. So there's lots of people who have huge healthcare liabilities but can't afford to get the insurance. All right.
And, sorry, David, it should also be said that in the 7 decades or so since the private insurance system kind of emerged and evolved since the mid-40s and 50s, the cost of healthcare has risen exponentially as well. So,
and the complexity and quality of healthcare has also improved.
Yep,
right?
That's right. But it's literally come at a price. I mean, it's much more expensive today to treat things than it was 70 years ago, proportionally speaking.
Yes. And people are living a lot longer and all these other kinds of things.
Right, which means they're sick late in life.
There's costs and benefits to everything, I guess. In thinking about, since Medicare and Medicaid in 65, Frank, what do you think are the big sort of turning points in terms of reforming healthcare, or trying to reform healthcare and trying to fix this sort of weird hobbled together system?
Well, the first one in the kind of modern saga of this, if you will, was the effort by under Bill Clinton, led by his wife, then First Lady Hillary Clinton, to reform the healthcare system.
This would have been 1993?
93, I think. And indeed, it was a big part of it contributed to the success of the Republicans in 1994 in those midterm elections and gave us Newt Gingrich, God help us. And Hillary Clinton's effort was a noble one, I think, and nobly intentioned. It was ultimately a little bit misguided. I think that the politics of having the First Lady take on something that was such a significant, an unelected First Lady, of course, such a significant proportion of the economy rubs some people the wrong way. Hillary Clinton really had lots of hearings, and it was particularly with insurance companies and healthcare providers, but also with patients and individuals who need healthcare to try and really get on top of this problem. And it was a very well-intentioned, I think noble's not an overstatement, effort that was ultimately quixotic because of the opposition, this time not necessarily of the AMA, although I think the AMA might have been hostile to it, but the insurance companies really, and the medical...
And the pharmaceutical companies.
Yes.
I think that the rise of Big Pharma as a power player in this debate in the second half of the 20th century is really important.
Yes, that's right.
Because your country doctor in 1900... had a bottle of pills that he gave to everybody that was basically kind of opiate and said, here, this will make you feel better, which it did. But it didn't cure anything. Whereas, the modern medicine is so much about prescribing various courses of treatments that will, keep you medicated and alive for a very long time, but it will also cost a lot of money.
Right, although the this is a slightly, no, it's a really important topic, but a kind of tangential observation that is, you know, if one looks at the other industrialized democracies with their national health services, the cost of drugs are not as high.
Yes.
Now, big pharma and the pharmaceutical companies defend the cost of drugs by saying, well, it's the price of developing them and so on, and that Americans are led to believe that the range of drugs available to them is greater than that, say, under the National Health Service here. And to some extent, that's true, but and that's one reason why they're more costly, so the newest drugs might be available, but at another level, I think it's nonsense. Mm. Drugs are not as expensive in the UK as they are in the US.
Yeah.
Even common drugs.
Yeah.
So there's a real discrepancy. But that's a slightly... Okay. It's an important conversation, but it's a slightly different conversation.
All right. So we had Clinton Care that didn't really go anywhere.
And then, in the late 90s, early aughts, when Mitt Romney was governor of Massachusetts, Romney sponsored what came to be called Romney Care, in fact, which was... essentially universal coverage in Massachusetts. And the way and the reason this is important is it will be a model for Obamacare. Essentially, the state of Massachusetts required everyone in the state to buy health insurance. And health insurance, subsidized health insurance, was made available to people. And this was seen as a model. And this was a model that came from conservative think tanks, partially in response to the debate over healthcare during the Clinton administration. Some conservative think tanks actually in Washington really gave some attention to, well, how do we solve this problem while maintaining a free market?
Yeah.
And their solution was to make it easier for people to acquire insurance. So in order to avoid having a nationalized healthcare system, which they was anathema to them because of its socialist associations, they wanted more people to have access to insurance. And by making insurance accessible to more people, of course, it brought down the price of insurance.
Yeah.
So the theory went. And so it was a market-driven solution to the problem. And it worked.
Yeah.
It was reasonably successful.
Yeah.
But the key element to it, sorry, David, is there was an element of compulsion.
Sure.
About it.
Yes.
You had to buy insurance.
Hmm.
They made it easier for you to buy insurance. And this would be a key element of Obamacare when it emerged in 2009.
Hmm. Actually, the mention there of socialism, actually, I think we should sort of brings up another thread in the sort of post-World War II era, really all the way through the present, is this sort of fear of socialist medicine.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, one of the cards that the medical insurance could play, the medical industry could play, or the opponents of health, national health care could play throughout that whole period is, this is a socialist program, we're Americans, we hate socialism, therefore you can't vote for this. I mean, there had been a part, I think, in Harry Truman's Fair Deal that had, an early version of it that had talked about national health care, and that gets stripped away because it gets labeled as being socialist. And so I think that sort of socialist, the Red Scare thread continues, really, in some ways. People don't like state health care. Why don't they like state health care? Because it's socialist.
Well,
socialism is bad.
Well, sorry, David. In fairness to its critics, it is socialist.
Yes. No, to be sure.
I mean, they're not wrong about
that.
But
the connotation that I think...
Taking that next step and saying, because it's socialist, it's bad, is a problematic conclusion.
Yes.
I mean, again, one can look at some of the other healthcare systems around the world and say, they might be socialist, but the outcomes are
pretty good. Yes.
So the association of, and that's always been an obstacle for Americans to nationalizing healthcare, for example. It's just in the debate over Obamacare, there was a lot of talk about single payer, that is kind of a national health system, not akin to what we have in the UK, would be a solution, but it was never a possibility because of its associations with socialism and socialized medicine. And there's a belief of, it's almost an article of faith in the United States, that socialized medicine by definition is inferior.
Yeah, which it's not.
Well, that's certainly not been my experience.
Well, and I don't think that the data doesn't, play that out. I mean, looking at, the healthcare outcomes that they, the World Health Organization, if you believe the World Health Organization,
socialist organization.
Yeah. Globalist socialist organization.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the outcomes in a place like Sweden or the UK are equivalent to or better than those in the United States. So socialized medicine in Canada doesn't seem to be bothering them.
Yes.
But that ideological dimension is a big part of this debate.
All right. And so let's just talk briefly about Obamacare, because in as much as one can talk briefly about Obamacare, what was Obamacare trying? So we did the Romney Care in Massachusetts. Some people have said Obamacare is just Romney Care, but on a national scale. But then Romney said he didn't like it. So explain all that.
Well, he wanted to be president of the United States.
Well, that's fair.
I think, and in order to win, the nomination of the Republican Party, he had to kind of repudiate his own program.
Okay.
Because I think it was as simple as that. So I think in 2012, Romney ran against Obamacare, which was, I think, essentially is Romney Care, on a national level. Obamacare, and it's a very complicated law.
Yes.
And we're simplifying greatly. But essentially, compels people to buy insurance or to pay a fine if they don't, although it's unclear how that can be enforced. The Supreme Court ruled this both legal and a tax, which was important, but we're probably getting too far into the weeds on this. But the point was that individuals should be covered.
Yeah.
There are two crucial elements to this. One is the responsibility for delivering this was given to the states.
Mm.
And states were expected to set up what were called insurance exchanges, essentially marketplaces, where the residents of the state could buy their insurance. We hear all this talk about Obamacare being in a death spiral and there being limited choice, and that's because in the states where the states controlled by Republicans that opposed Obamacare did not set up the exchanges or refused to participate. And so that did mean that although people were required to get insurance, their options were limited. And so to some extent, the system, to the extent that it's failing, and I think that the arguments that Obamacare is failing are overdone and they serve a political interest, but to the extent that there are difficulties with Obamacare, and there are, to some extent, those have been caused by the people seeking to obstruct it, and to stop its implementation. So many of those opponents of Obamacare are turning around and saying, it's failing, we need to repeal and replace it, but it's failing because of their opposition, not because of the inherent flaws in the program. But Obama, the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as it's known, was a massive step forward in public health terms for the United States, or theoretically it was, when it was adopted in 2010. And the current bill, the bill passed by the House a month or so ago, and the Senate revision of that bill, are attempts to repeal and replace Obamacare, as the Republicans like to say.
Mm.
They've boxed themselves in to some extent because it's an article of faith. It has been an article of faith for Republicans since 2010 that this must be repealed and replaced. The problem with repealing it is replacing it.
Yeah.
Because people have become dependent on Obamacare already. Yeah. And there are some key elements of Obamacare that we should note. Pre-existing conditions were removed as a reason to deny people insurance.
Yeah.
So insurance companies could no longer charge people more because they have pre-existing conditions. That was crucial. Young people could be covered on their parents' insurance up until the age of 26, which was an important step. People who previously couldn't afford insurance because they've been ill before were now covered, and young people were covered. And so these provisions have proved incredibly important.
And popular,
yes. And because of that popularity, they're going to be very difficult to take away.
Yeah. And so I think the Republicans are trying to say, we're going to repeal and replace this, but we're going to keep the bits you like, without recognizing that, or at least admitting that the pieces that people like are intimately connected with the pieces that people don't.
Or the things that Republicans don't like.
Yeah, the people who are voting for them and saying repeal and replace. But
yes.
Yeah.
And there are all kinds of problems with the present bill. I mean, in part, we know relatively little about it. We, only a kind of summary was released last week. It hasn't been properly scored, that is vetted by the Congressional Budget Office to find out what it will cost and how many people will be affected and things like that. So senators are being asked to vote on something without really having access to the full range of facts with regard to its implications. And the public doesn't necessarily know about it because it was drafted in secret.
Yeah.
And one of the criticisms that Republicans made about Obamacare was that it allegedly was drafted, the Affordable Care Act was supposedly drafted in secret. Well, it was debated for over a year and there were multiple hearings. This has been drafted over the course of a month. And
most senators didn't even see it.
No, only 13 senators were involved in this. Yeah. And so it's legislation that has been drafted in secret and its implications are not fully known. And one figure that one keeps hearing is that that healthcare, because it's so expensive and so important, is 1/6 of the U.S. economy.
Yeah.
And so this bill is going to affect 1/6 of the largest economy in the world.
Mm.
And essentially the bill was drafted in secret and the people voting on it don't necessarily know exactly what they're voting on.
Yeah. So regardless of the merits of this bill, which I think we both agree is probably a really bad bill. I mean, it looks like it's the early version of it seems like it's going to take healthcare away from lots and lots of people.
Yes. More than 20 million.
Yeah.
By one.
It's taking away Medicaid and all kinds of things from lots of people who desperately need it. Is there a bill that could fix the American healthcare system the weird way it's set up? Or should they just scrap it and say, Canada, UK, tell us what to do?
You're asking for an opinion. I mean, having lived for 25 years in a single payer healthcare system, I would strongly recommend it. I look at all healthcare systems. Are face a fundamental problem and challenge, I should say, which is they're allocating resources that are ultimately finite. No matter how you decide to allocate them, they're finite at some level. They allocating finite resources to people in need and sometimes quite acute need and distress. And then you factor in that distress and the fact that because you're dealing with sick people, the outcomes aren't always good. Sometimes people get very good care and they die.
Yeah.
Sometimes people get bad care and they die. But the point is, in every single healthcare system in the world, at the edges, there are horror stories.
Yes.
And so when on the right in the United States, one often hears horror stories from the National Health Service in Britain or Canada or what have you. It's like, oh, well, somebody waited so long and they died while they were waiting for treatment or what have you. And those stories may or may not be true. But the point is, because you're ultimately allocating finite resources to people who are in distress, it's a difficult thing to do.
Hmm.
There seem to me to be real advantage to nationalized health. And again, the outcomes one sees in the UK or in various countries in Europe or in Canada seem to be quite good. One of the important things is, to my mind, is equity and justice. I mean, we're straying into the editorializing here, but there's
our podcast. We can do whatever we want.
We can, I guess. But there's an element of fairness to it, and it's treatment for all according to need rather than according to money. And to my own mind, that's a good thing, and something to be. Everybody's covered.
Yeah.
Also gives people freedom of movement in the labor market, which should appeal to conservatives.
It is, yeah.
If you like market-driven solutions, so people here in Britain, for example, don't have to make employment decisions or decisions about where they're going to live based on their healthcare because they know they're going to have healthcare.
Yeah.
It also means that when people lose their job, they don't necessarily lose their lives.
Yeah. That's one of the cruelest things about the American system is if you do lose your job, you lose your health care.
Right.
And there's there's COBRA and other kinds of things that let you keep it for like a month or two. But, that's, somebody who's going through a health crisis and loses their job, that's compounding it in a way, I think, that you couldn't, you know, write it more cruelly if you wanted to.
Right. Losing one's job is terrible, but to lose one's health care along with one's job is, you know, compounds the misery and, frankly, the pressure that people are under when they when they're made unemployed. So, so in answer to your question, is there a bill? I don't know. No. I mean, it seems to me that Obamacare was a well-intentioned and frankly, noble effort, I'm going to use that word again, to extend coverage and to cover everybody. That was the goal. That was the intention. Within the confines of the American medical care system and the way it evolved along the lines we've discussed. So it was seeking to reconcile private insurance with healthcare for all. It seems to me single-payer healthcare was not on the cards in the United States, at least not yet.
All right, Frank, I guess it's time for our last drops. What do you got?
I want to give a shout-out to the Gilda Lehrman Institute for American History in New York. The Gilda Lehrman Institute's been around for about 20 or 25 years. It's it does a variety of things, but one of the things it does is sponsor a series of seminars, summer seminars, for school teachers. And I had the, for the past several years, I've hosted one of these seminars, and I hosted one last week here in Edinburgh for 35 school teachers from around the US. And the theme was Thomas Jefferson and the Age of the Enlightenment. And they're absolutely wonderful. The teachers are wonderful. They come from public schools and private schools. They come from religious schools and secular schools. They come from around the country. And it's incredibly uplifting, frankly, to encounter these teachers. And it gives one, you know, in a moment when the, frankly, the political culture in the country is awful.
Yeah.
And it seems that everything is awful. It's quite inspiring to meet teachers from across the country who represent, they come from across the political spectrum. They represent. They come. They represent different faiths and no faiths, and different ethnic and racial groups. And to they're very, very dedicated to their students, and it's quite inspiring. And the Gilda Lehrman Institute runs these seminars and has done so for many years around the country, and there are several outside of the United States as well. It's just a fabulous program, and I can endorse it hard. So if we have any teachers listening, please apply for next summer. Yes. We'd love to have you in Edinburgh.
And this is a really good time of year. You have it every year in Edinburgh where it's not too crowded. All the students have gone. The festival crowds haven't arrived. So all the you can see the city and learn some history. So.
That's right. And it's a wonderful program.
All right. Well,
what about you, David?
I guess Gilda Lehrman's based in New York. And so I've got another New York city-related endorsement. June is Gay History Month. Frank, do you know why June is Gay History Month?
I don't, actually.
Oh, okay. June is Gay History
Month. Tell me, David.
Yeah, okay. June is Gay
History. I know that there were pride parades all over the world yesterday.
Yes. And actually, I think the Edinburgh one was a week ago. But yeah, so they're all in June. The reason is because June is the month in which the Stonewall Riots happened in New York City in 1969. I imagine many people who are listening to this are familiar generally with the story, but the Stonewall Riots were the Stonewall Bar, the Stonewall Inn was a bar in Greenwich Village in Manhattan in the late 1960s. Police would often raid gay bars, which were illegal. They didn't have liquor licenses for complicated reasons. And in this case, the patrons of the bar fought back against the police. And it's often seen as being one of the sort of foundational events of the gay liberation movement. So anyway, I was in New York a year ago, and I said, "Well, I've never been to the Stonewall Bar, and I'm sorry, why not go?" So I decided to go and went down there. This is actually the same month that Obama named it as a national landmark. Right. He did it like actually a couple of weeks after I was there. And so I went into this. Have you been to the?
I haven't.
Okay, it's a nice little, bar. I was there in the afternoon, so I think I had the whole place to myself. It was me and the barkeeper, and it's not actually the original bar. It looks like the space had been sort of reused multiple times since 1969, but it's on the same spot. it's not quite as big as the original, but it's sort of a recreation, if you will. So it's sort of like Globe's Theater in terms of it's in the right spot and it looks the right, but it's not actually the thing. And it was very nice, and then they had some artifacts related to the riot there, and they had beer, and you know what else is, you know, everything else is right in the world. Here's one thing I was not suspecting. There's a very small park outside the bar, which is where the riot actually took place, the Christopher Street Park. And it's one of these New York parks that's barely big enough to be called a park. It's really a sort of a sort of an elongated triangle that its widest point is not more than maybe 20, 30 feet wide. So it's one of these really tiny little parks. It's room for like a tree and a bench, and that's really the whole park. But the central figure in the park is a statue of the Civil War general, Phil Sheridan.
Oh.
So, which is not a part of the story that I'd ever, you know, the riot happens in the middle of this park around the statue of Phil Sheridan. And I thought that was interesting. So next time you're in New York, I highly recommend going to the Stonewall Inn, see the historic site, but then also check out the statue of Phil Sheridan outside.
Excellent. All right. Thank you. Hope you feel better.
Oh, yeah. Cheers.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.